tonight on Arena. We hear from post-punk performance poet Sinead O'Brien and Roxanna Nicklaim of Fair City and Laura Quirk of Limoncello at the first Fortnight Festival. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Today is Nullag na Mann, and I hope that Manon na Héireann, in fact, Manon an Domhan na Fada, all of our female listeners are having a very special day. So to celebrate Nullag na Mann, we've asked Sinead Gleeson, the editor of The Art of the Glimpse, her collection of 100 Irish short stories, to look at some stories by women writers, and she's come up with four real humdingers that we'll take a look at over the next 15 or 20 minutes or so. I wonder to what extent, Sinead, when you were choosing the stories for us for tonight, did the whole idea of Nullag na Mann, was it in your mind? Did you choose with that festival in mind?
Very much so, Sean. I think anybody who isn't familiar with the day, traditionally it's the day that women are asked to, you know, they're told they can put their feet up after the hard work, the domestic work, the household labour of the 12 days of Christmas and running around after everybody else. So I wanted to look at stories that challenge the idea of what it is to be a woman in the home, or to be, the female role, whether that's mother or sister or daughter, and the kind of duties and impositions that are so often put up upon women by either their families or by society or by their own body in these cases. So there are four very different stories and they're not all Irish, but I hope that kind of will resound with people on this particular day.
The husband stitch, the title of this is enough to make you quake. Well, to make me quake at any rate, your first choice of story by Carmen Murillo. Is it Machado? Is that how I say her surname?
Machado, yeah, Machado.
Machado. Now, this comes from our collection.
In fact, she's...
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think I've been on with you before discussing her work, Sean. We've discussed her short stories and she published a memoir last year, and I think it's just a very distinct and unique kind of writer. So this story comes from that collection, Her Body and Other Parties.
Now, I was reading a writer today who said that when this story, The Husband Stitch, is taught in a fiction workshop, it's unlike any other teaching experience that they have. The men in the class don't speak. Maybe if you explain the few ideas around, or the few versions of what that title refers to, The Husband Stitch, we'll get an idea why perhaps men go very quiet at this story.
Well, the story is the story of a young woman who meets a young man, which is what happens at the start, and she's passionately and sort of wholly, bodily in love with him. And the story kind of traces their whole relationship, but also does a lot of other things in the meantime. At one point in the story, she has a baby, and the husband stitch is referred to as a certain kind of nod and wink conversation that happens between husbands and doctors, and did at one time, that would might happen to a woman's body after she has delivered a baby. To make things a bit more pleasurable for a man down the road after children. So the whole idea is quite horrifying, but all what Maria Machado does in her work all the time is subvert and sort of pillory a lot of the time. So the husband in this story does ask for this to be done, but it's not really about the birth and it's not really about their child. It's about the fact that this woman all through her life has a green ribbon around her neck, and the husband wants to know what it's for and he wants to untie it. And the whole the way through the story and their life, he asks her about it. And it actually, it mimics an old story from folklore, the idea of a woman wearing a ribbon around her neck and every man she encounters being enticed by her, but being enticed by the mystery of the ribbon. You know, what is it? Why can't I have it? Why can't I take it off you? So the story builds towards that he gets increasingly more interested in what the ribbon is, what it represents and why she won't allow him near it.
Would you read a little section from The Husband Stitch for us, Sinead?
Certainly. I'll read quite near to the start. And I think it really, they get married very young, this couple, and they're just full of desire and love for each other. And the story starts with her basically wanting this man. She's obsessed with the idea of him. So I'll just read a bit from the start. In the beginning, I know I want him before he does. This isn't how things are done, but this is how I am going to do them. I'm at a neighbour's party with my parents and I'm 17. Though my father didn't notice, I drank half a glass of white wine in the kitchen a few minutes ago with the neighbour's teenage daughter, and everything is soft like a fresh oil painting. The boy is not facing me, but I see the muscles of his neck and upper back, how he fairly strains out of his button-down shirt. I run slick. It isn't that I don't have choices. I am beautiful. I have a pretty mouth. I have a breast that heaves out of my dresses in a way that seems innocent and perverse all at the same time. I am a good girl from a good family. But he is a little craggy in that way that sometimes men are. And I want. And it just ends with that. Not even I want him, just I want. It's a great closing paragraph.
It certainly is. And that whole idea of want and any sort of sexual desire and the expression of sexual love is all over this story. There are no holds barred at all. It's very explicit, but not in any kind of prurient way.
No, it's actually, and it's a really interesting way to show a very a marriage that's very sexual and very very full of desire all through the years, because the story goes on for decades. It goes, you know, they do have this baby, and the baby grows up and goes to college, and all through their life they're still very connected. They're very happy. They're very physically interested in each other. But one thing that Machado does, when I say combining very modern elements with this kind of folkloric fairy tale, what she also does is, as well as looking at this woman's life and asking what it is to be a mother and be desired and be female and be married, she brings in all these other strange other little stories. So you get sort of 10 or 12 mini stories within the story, including one of a mother and daughter who go to Paris and stay in a hotel. The mother gets sick. The daughter's sent to get the doctor. When she comes back, the mother's gone. The room is different. It's been repainted. All the furniture is changed around. And the hotel staff tell her, "You're mad. You were never here. We don't know you. Who are you speaking of?" And so she's really interested in bringing in all different types of female stories also throughout the story, you can, and if anyone is interested in it, you can actually read it online. It was published by Granta and it's on the Granta website. And she does this little kind of stage directions almost, which she advises you in which voice to read each section of the story. So she's incredibly multi-layered, skilled sort of writer. Even the work is very feminist, but she's dealing with an awful lot of different things. She wrote a memoir this year and it was unlike anything I'd ever heard in my life, in that she did different genres for different chapters. So one part of her life was a road trip, one part was written like Mrs. Dalloway, another part was like lesbian pulp. So she's somebody who likes to change things up and gear up and down and move between genres. She's a very multi-genre kind of writer, but very literary too. But I think she's brilliant.
What about that? I mean, I accept what you're saying about bringing in all the other women's stories. That is an interesting aspect to the story. But I wanted to get back to the couple at the centre of it, and I wanted to find out what was going to happen with that green ribbon, which we're not going to tell anybody, because it isn't the joy of reading it that you find out about that. But do those little diversions into other stories, do they get in the way of the thrust of the main plot for you, or did they just add layers to it?
I know exactly what you mean, because the central story is so compelling that you don't want to be distracted from it. At the same time, I think the whole point of a story like this is to show the multiplicity of womanhood, to show that there are many ways to be female, to be a mother, to be a daughter, to be loved, to be not loved. And I think that's what she's trying to do, to show you that while I'm telling you a conventional love story chronologically from start to finish, and it, you know, and there's we won't reveal the ending because you do find out about the green ribbon, she's trying to show you that there are loads of other lives that maybe aren't being lived in this way, and that the experience of lived womanhood varies for everybody. And I think that's what's so clever about it, that sort of weaving. It's kind of like an accordion type story with all these other little pieces in between. But I thought it really worked.
All right, that's The Husband Stitch by Carmen Mario Machado, the first choice for Sinead Gleeson for today, Nullag na Mban. It's a long enough short story, and those little diversions certainly add to the length of it. The second story that you've chosen for us, The Girl, this is a much shorter short story for sure, Sinead.
I'm very fond of short story writers who can do things with extreme brevity, and this story is 650 words, so it's extremely short. It's less than a couple of pages, and it's a writer I think is very well known in America but is not as well known over here, called Jamaica Kincaid. She's been publishing for years. She's won an awful lot of awards. She's Antiguan American, so she writes a lot about her, the experience of the immigrant, the experience of being a woman of colour, and this is a story of hers that it's probably one of her best known stories. It's called Girl. and it's sort of written as an incantation almost. It's a mother back from, you know, Antigua telling her daughter, this is how you need to be if you want someone to notice you, but not notice you too much, but notice you enough to get you a husband, but get you a husband that doesn't want to look at other women. And it's basically a sort of it reads like a poem or a letter from a mother to a daughter, sort of, but it's quite chastising. It's like a set of instructions. It's a monologue, even though there are little bits of brackets in the story where the daughter is trying to get a word in edgeways and you can hear the mother isn't listening. But I think she hasn't been published here massively, but Picador are about to publish 10 of her books over the next couple of years, including the collection At the Bottom of the River that this story, Girl, comes from. Right. It was first published in 1983.
Maybe we could hear a section from this. And this really is, it's a kind of a home economics lesson, because it's a rather chastising mother that's involved here in more ways than one. But let's hear the section that you're going to read for us, a little bit of a recipe or cooking advice you're going to give us here, Sinead.
Yeah, and also I just pointed the whole two pages. There's a lot. She repeats phrases, and again, it's the idea. Like it's almost you get sort of like transfixed by listening to the same words and phrases keep coming up. But you'll hear a sense of that in this bit. This is from the middle of the story, where she's being told again more advice from her mother. This is how to sew on a button. This is how to make a buttonhole for the button you have just sewed on. This is how to hem a dress when you see the hem coming down to prevent yourself from looking like the slut I know you were so bent on becoming. This is how you iron your father's khaki shirt so it doesn't have a crease. This is how you iron your father's khaki pants so they don't have a crease. This is how you grow okra far from the house because okra harbours red ants. This is how you smile to someone you don't like very much. This is how you smile to someone you don't like at all. This is how you smile to someone you like completely. And the whole story is like that. It's rhythmic. It's like a chant almost.
Yeah, and as you say, there are phrases that are repeated time and time again, but the one that stopped me in my tracks, and I presume stops lots of people in their tracks when they read it, is the reference constantly, you had it there, stop your hem from coming down and so to present yourself from looking like the slut I know you are so bent on becoming. She repeats this phrase using the word slut time and time again.
It's so full on, and again, what's contained within the story. It's obviously coming from a place of love, but it's coming from a place of fear, and it's trying to project shame onto the daughter that you shouldn't want to be looked at. You don't want to be looked at too much, and you don't want people to speak about you or talk about you in a negative way. It's about how to be a wife, how to be a perfect woman, how to run a home. But the whole tone of it is there's no joy in it. There's nothing. She doesn't talk to her at all in the two pages about love. You know, this is what it's like to be loved. This is how it is to give love. It's all about the do's and don'ts. So it's very chastising, and because there's so little of the daughter in it, you already know a lot about their relationship. And I think that's the skill of a writer like this, to be able to do it in 650 words. She's not telling you what the relationship is, but she really is.
Well, you've no doubt about who's in charge or who thinks she's in charge at any rate when you get through those 650 words. That's Jamaica Kincaid, a story called Girl. And that's the second choice of Sinead Egan for us. Or I beg your pardon, Sinead Gleeson for us on this Nullig na Mann. Right, third choice. Another kind of surreal aspect I felt to this story, Sinead. This is Mrs. Fox by Sarah Hall. Tell me a little bit about Sarah Hall first. Very successful writer.
Yeah, very much so. This story actually won the BBC National Short Story Award in 2013. It was just the first time I read it, and it just blew me away. I hadn't seen or read anything like it. A lot of Sarah Hall's work, and she had a collection published just last year called Sudden Traveller. She's very interested in kind of anthropomorphic work. Sometimes women turn into creatures or have strange sort of lives, and yet there's something about her that the sentences are so brief and sparse. They're like a beat of a drum. She's very, very good at the sort of lyrical short sentence, but very good at bringing you into making very strange, surreal situations seem absolutely normal. And that's what she does so well in this story, which at the start seems to be about a married couple who are happy, content. No, nobody's got the upper hand. Everything seems fine. And what happens? And it's not a giveaway to say this either. Again, if you Google for this story on a website called Toast, you can read it, and I recommend you do. So very quickly into the story, what happens? Maybe I'll read the reading first, and I can tell you afterwards
sure.
what happens.
Well, let's hear this, because this is where we get the big bit of news, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. So they've gone out to the forest, the husband and wife, for a walk, and the wife's been acting strange for a couple of days. She's been throwing up, her skin looks funny. The husband is thinking, God, I wonder if she's ill. And they go out for a walk, and the wife starts to chase after a creature she sees in the forest. You think it's a bird, and then something else happens. So this is where we pick it up. At his feet, she sits, her tail rearing, exceptional winged ears, eyes like the spectrum of her blended fur. He kneels and with absolute tenderness touches the ruff of her neck. What can be decided in a few moments that will not be questioned for a lifetime? He collects her coat from the nearby bushes. He moves to place it gently around her. She does not resist. And his arms cautiously reach under, lifting her. The moderate weight of a mid-sized mammal, the scent of musk, gland, and faintly, faintly her perfume, a dirty rose. And still in the woods on the apron of grassland, no one is hiking, though soon there will be dogs tugging against leads, old couples, children gadding about. Down the path he walks, holding his fox. Her brightness escapes the coat at both ends. It is like trying to wrap fire. His warmth, her warmth, against his chest is astonishing for a wife who always felt the cold in her hands and feet. She is calm. She does not struggle. And he bears her sacrifice, a forest pieta.
There you go. That's Sinead Gleeson reading from Mrs. Fox by Sarah Hall, the third of four stories that she's chosen for us on today, Nulling Them On. There is something beautiful in this story in some ways, Sinead. The fact that love endures and that you accept the person you love, no matter what he or she may be or may become, you've got to stick with them type of thing.
That's exactly what the story is about. It's not about that man and woman, wife turns into fox, even though it is. But the rest of the story is about the fact that the husband is willing to accept her for who she is and doesn't want to let her go. And then obviously that's probably not going to be a sustainable situation, but he wants to believe that it is. And it is about the fact that love can't be decimated by even huge changes in somebody, even your wife becoming a fox. But it's a stunning, stunning story. And again, on a sentence level, I think it's superb. A lot of her work is quite like this. Yeah. And I think there's been a lot of people like Daisy Johnson, maybe coming after her, would be somebody who'd be very influenced by her. And I just think it's, I've read it several times since I first read it, and it gets better.
Well, there's two sides to the change aspect of it. Love endures even if your wife becomes a fox, or even if your husband doesn't become a fox. both loves kind of endure, which I think is interesting. Let's move on then to your final choice.
Yeah, why is it all on her?
Exactly. Your final choice then, close to home, this one, and delighted that you chose a Maeve Brennan story. Her birthday today, in fact, and this story is The Morning After the Big Fire. We're back in 48 Cherryfield Avenue. What's happening here?
Yeah, I could have picked, in terms of the connection to Nulling Them On and the domestic and the household, you could pick most of Maeve Brennan's stories, particularly anything from The Springs of Affection. Six or seven of those stories are set in Cherryfield Avenue, which is the house that Maeve Brennan actually grew up in. And I think so many of her stories are about the small spaces, are about the status and class around the house. She wrote a lot of stories about families called the Durdens, it's more about a marriage that's gone very bad. So there's one gas fire, one coal fire. There's a back bedroom that has lino, and the rest of the house is carpeted. So Maeve Brennan is really good at making political comments about relationships and about class and families by the things that they own and the furniture they have. And this is through all her work. But I decided to pick this story. It's a story I chose for the Art of the Glimpse. It's called The Morning After the Big Fire, and it's very short. And again, it's set in that house, and it's told to a child's eye point of view, which we assume might be Maeve. There was a garage at the back of the row of houses where she lived, and one day, great excitement, there's a fire. And everybody in the road is running around, sort of talking about it and wanting to be part of the action. And she's never forgotten it. And it's one of those things that when she looks back through her whole life, and she says in the first paragraph, we moved out of there when I was 18, but she never forgot that moment, the sense of danger and the proximity to it, while still feeling safe. And it's just wonderfully evocative story of childhood and nostalgia, but also very rooted in the home.
What section are you going to read from this for us?
I'm going to read to close to the end, because again, people don't think of Maeve Brennan as a funny writer, as a comic writer necessarily. Not in her fiction anyway. She is in her non-fiction. But at the end of this couple of paragraphs are very, I think it's just a brilliant line. It was not long before the McRorys put up another garage made of silvery, corrugated metal stuff that looked garish and glaring against our garden wall. It cut off more of our view than the old building had. My father said the odds were all against another fire there, but I remembered that fine dark morning with all the excitement and my own importance, and I longed for just another like it. This time, however, I was determined to discover the blaze before my father did, and I watched the garage closely, as much of it as I could see, for signs that it might be ready to go up again in flames. But I was disappointed. It stood, and was still standing, ugly as ever, when we left the house years later. But still, for a long time I used to think that if some child should steal around there with a match one night and set it blazing again, I would never blame her. As long as she let me be first with the news.
Yeah, it's a great finishing line, isn't it? That's the morning after the big fire from Maeve Brennan, the final choice of Sinead Gleeson on this Nothing the Man. So that, as you said, Sinead, available in The Art of the Glimpse, your own recent edition, 100 Irish Short Stories. It's also there, the original Maeve Brennan collection, Springs of Affection. It's also on the New Yorker website, isn't it? If you have a subscription, you can log in there and you can read everything, in fact, if you have a subscription, right back in the archives.
You actually can, and even better, our great writer Roddy Doyle was distantly related to Maeve Brennan, and he reads on the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. You can listen to it, and he discusses her story Christmas Eve with Deborah Treisman, and you can listen to Roddy reading the story and discussing the story. And it's funny, today on Twitter, a writer called Kat Hogan has been doing 100 days of the Art of the Glimpse hashtag, a sort of read-along where you read one story from the book in order. And as it happened, spookily, today was Maeve Brennan's story, so a lot of people were reading the story online today, which was wonderful to see.
Well, there you go. And if they're looking for three others, you've given us three great suggestions. Mrs. Fox, available on that Toast, and that's to.st is how the Toast magazine.
That's it.
And then the very first story that we spoke about, The Husband Stitch, is available on the Granta website. Can we get the Kincaid story anywhere, he's short as it is?
Not yet, but keep an eye out for Picador reissuing her story collection that it's from. I think it's going to be this year. It's called At the Bottom of the River, the collection it's in, but every story in that is just brilliant anyway, so it's worth maybe borrowboxing it from the library if you can't get to a bookshop at the moment.
Okay, listen, Sinead, and thanks very much for your suggestions for us on this Nothing to Man, and enjoy the rest of the evening, whatever it is you're getting up to or not getting up to, as the case may be.
Gurmagasam.
29 minutes past 7 on Wednesday night's Arena. Central to the first fortnight festival are the therapy sessions. This is a quartet of events curated by and emceed by spoken word poet Stephen James Smith. Each of the four evenings is given over to a particular city, Dublin, Belfast, Cork and or Galway, and their musicians and poets. It opens on the 8th of January in Dublin. Two of the guests that evening join me now on the line, singer-songwriter Laura Quirk from the folk duo Limoncello and spoken word artist and actor Roxana Nicklame, and happy Nothing the Man to both of you. Let's start with that. And Roxana, in fact, you're performing three spoken word pieces on the 8th of January, one of which links very much, it seems to me, into Nothing the Man. Chucky Ar Manaw. Tell me more.
it's in the name, really. But yeah, it's basically a piece I wrote a couple of years ago, and it was kind of around the repeal time when it was kind of coming up to the referendum, and I remember just kind of speaking to like kind of older women, like my grandmother or my own mother, just about all the kind of things that women in Ireland have had to fight for. Just how they've always had to kind of fight for any kind of autonomy or any kind of freedoms, and how that fight still hasn't ended. So it just made me very angry, and a lot of poetry comes from that kind of fire.
Well, fair enough, a good fire, I would have thought, for inspiration. Yeah. Will you perform a little bit of it for us, Roxana?
I will indeed, yeah. I have an edited version of the actual poem that I'll be doing on the night. Do you want me to do it now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, okay. And the men screamed Chucka Ar Law as they fought for a new Ireland, a better Ireland, a better Ireland for them or a better Ireland for all. It didn't matter right there and then, it just mattered that we had an Ireland. So Sinn Féin of all, invite the Catholic Church round and we'll build ourselves a doll. maybe Ireland just isn't ready for us, we thought. So we sat in silence and we listened in awe. We listened as they told us that free mother and child care was an expense that they were not willing to give. It's up to God now whether or not the mother and child live. We couldn't have bodily autonomy, but our babies could be a commodity, sold to the Yanks without telling us where they went. Our babies were dragged away from us and we were told that they would pray for us because our bastard children could never be loved, not even by God. It's all for the greater glory of God. That was their motto. Meanwhile, a 15-year-old is dying giving birth in the grotto. We've been called Jezebels since this state's inception, but never more than we fought to get access to contraception because we had the audacity to say that maybe we'd like the choice to not spend our whole fertile lives carrying a baby. They wrote laws that hardly considered us, just enough to make sure that we knew our place, and that place was in the home. This better Ireland left us raw with each crappy law, a constitution devoid of gra for mana, but now we say no, chuck it our law. Now we can build a new Ireland because this one needs repairing. Our new Ireland, our better Ireland, will be a place that's caring, and the place of a woman won't just be a home when she's childbearing. We will be heard, we will be listened to, no more silent despairing, because we are raging, we are roaring, and we are rearing. We are Manana Heron.
That is a great rhyme at the end. We are raring, we are Manana Heron. Of course, and you're quoting directly. I said, well, Manana Heron is a phrase in and of itself, but you're quoting President Mary Robinson, former President Mary Robinson, when you speak to Manana Heron in that way. I love the title of the poem as well. Chucky Ar Manaw. Let me go to Laura Quirk. I'll stay where you are, Roxanne. I'll come back to you for sure. Laura, the First Fortnight Festival, this is a festival actually that's quite close to your own heart, if I don't knock the studio down and bang in the microphone here. This is a festival that's quite close to your own heart. Tell me why.
Yeah, well, I think that really, I think we don't pay enough attention to our mental health in our society or in ourselves. And it's just great to be involved in a festival that challenges the stigma around mental health because it just makes a bad problem worse, really. I love the way that First Fortnight does this by organising a festival, a celebration. During this particularly dark, cold month of January, I think a celebration of our mental health and of our humanness, the fact that we're human and we feel things like Roxanne was saying there, like that fire that of anger or that fire of sadness, or of joy, excitement, fear, anything like that. It's not something to be afraid of it or to be solemn or serious about it, something to celebrate and a very precious and tender thing, I think that. Yeah, so it is, it's close to my heart in the fact that I think it should be close to all of our hearts, really.
Of course. And I think you pick up on something important there, whatever about any January, this particular January it seems to have a particular darkness about it, given that we were all hoping for great things to kick in the minute 2021 arrived on our doorsteps. But unfortunately, we seem to be kind of back where we were almost last March. But the first 2 weeks of January, they're a good time, Roxanna, I suppose, for us to take stock and to look at perhaps things that we stigmatise and things that we have preconceived notions about and to question ourselves. And that's, I guess, what this festival is all about.
Yeah, definitely. I think just with the nature of New Year's, we it's a time of kind of reflection and resolutions and stuff like that. But I think more than anything this year, I kind of think this should be a thing for every year, but basically not to be too hard on ourselves. I think sometimes after Christmas, Blue Monday is coming up, and I'm not sure if that's this Monday or next Monday, but it's basically where people feel the lowest.
Yeah.
Because, that kind of the magic of Christmas is gone, the reality of kind of not having money, you've put on weight, you're not yourself, you've already given up on your resolutions, you're kind of feeling bad about yourself. So it's already a really low time. And then with the year we've had, it's really hard. And sometimes you kind of feel like, okay, well, I need to be more productive, I need to do this, I need to do that, and this is what I should be doing. And I actually think the best thing at this time for our mental health is to just actually give ourselves a break and to be kinder to ourselves. Because I think there is a thing, I was speaking earlier to somebody about at the start of this pandemic, I was going, oh, it'll give me loads of time to write. I'll be able to write loads of great poetry. I'll be able to do this. I'll be able to do that. And then that kind of, nearly a coming down feeling, because I actually couldn't do it because I was in such a weird kind of space, and then beating myself up. And then I just decided, no, like, this shouldn't be a time where we feel like we have to keep doing stuff and we have to. I think just us getting up and, you know, going out every day is enough.
That's enough to be getting on with.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think celebration was a great word there, because I think it's just to celebrate. I mean, first fortnight is obviously about mental health and breaking stigma, but also a celebration of that in
sure.
a way of, you know, we all do feel like this at different times, and especially within the arts, because people in the arts
being particularly affected. Yeah,
I mean, yeah,
I'm thinking actually of Laura, that this time last year, I don't know, it was very close to the first part of early January, you were with us in at Temple Bar Tradfest. We were launching the festival,
yeah. Yeah,
and yourself and Claire Kinsella, the other half of the Limoncello Quartet, were there with us with the Silken Thomas, performing in front of a live audience, which is something you haven't been able to do for the most of 2020, let's face it, and won't be able to do for a little while yet. But I'll come back to, you know, how you're both dealing with all of that. But maybe we listen to a little bit of a track that we have from you, Laura, which is Libra. Will you tell me a little bit about this before we listen?
Yeah, it's one that's actually, it's kind of hard for me to explain, but I'll give it a go. I suppose, like, all I kind of see, like, all of our, well, me personally, a lot of my worries and anxieties are all quite insignificant things in the grand scheme of the world. And I kind of look at them as like tiny little particles of dust, you know. But once, like, these tiny little particles of dust sort of accumulate, and one day I sort of walk into my mind, or the room of my mind, whatever it is, and the place is filthy. It's just covered in dust and in these things that I haven't dealt with. So I suppose this song was my attempt at cleaning or dusting off those kind of worries and fears and things. Yeah.
And I suppose I presume Libra here is a bit of a reference to some kind of freedom when the cleaning up is done. Let's have a listen.
It's a sort of a reference to balance, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't bring it down to the ground to see dust swirling around. It's caused more problems for man than
just the opening section there of Libra from Limoncello, and Laura Quirk of Limoncello is with me on the line this evening, as is Roxana McLean, both of whom are involved in this year's First Fortnight Festival. And of course, my misreading of the word Libra there, and it's in the first line of the song, Laura, Libra as in the scales of the star sign, I guess, as opposed to Libra with an E at the end, which is freedom. Yeah. So a different thing altogether.
I think I was sort of having a bit of crack there, because I sometimes read star signs and I kind of know they're ridiculous, and at the same time they sort of give me a certain amount of comfort. And so I was saying that sometimes you just want something to give you a way, you know, like I think that's kind of why people see or at one point in time saw a worth of religion, yeah, or something like that. You just want a way. And so I think that's kind of what that song was for me. Instead of, I was just kind of making fun of myself.
I suppose that's part of what you're talking about, not taking things too seriously at the beginning of the year, to not go too hard on yourself and have a bit of a laugh at yourself as well. Yeah, absolutely. And Roxana, you're also an actor. You play Erica in Fair City. We've done a lot of theatre over time as well. Spoken word, and obviously Fair City was back happening. I don't know what state you'll be in now when these new restrictions start to come back into play. But spoken word and theatre, obviously, all relying on live audience, all relying on public performance. Did that make 2020 hard? You must have been delighted when Fair City came back and was actually filming again.
Yeah, I mean, that's and actually for a while with Fair City, we hadn't heard anything. No one knew because, you know, it was obviously the word of the year, unprecedented. Mm. So when that came back, at least I had that kind of relief. But yeah, I think, I mean, the thing about theatres and spoken word is that, you know, we don't even have a time frame, and, you know, you can kind of bear something if you're going, okay, look, it's just going to be a year and da 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 da. But we're not even sure about that. And so it can be kind of hard, again, to bring it back to mental health. You know, it can be really hard just to kind of, I mean, the job is very insecure at the best of times anyway, but then to add this to it. And of course, you know, I can understand why, because even when cinemas opened again briefly and the shops opened, it was still, theatres were still kind of left. Yeah. And I totally understand why. And, you know, but it can just be really hard when you're kind of, you know, even well, your career, when you're...
Yeah, it's your way of making a living. But you did do a bit of writing. You wrote There Will Be, I think it was simply called, wasn't it, last summer? Yeah. And that you're going to perform that at the therapy sessions as well as part of Fortnight.
Yeah. That is a bit more kind of hopeful, I think. I mean, it can be read over. But yeah, that's kind of about the celebration of life and joy and crack that we're going to have. Because, I mean, it does feel like it'll never end. It feels like, you know, we're never just going to be, like you were talking about the Trad Festival last year and being in a crowd, like the thought of it is just so alien to us right now. We've adapted so quickly to this new life, but it will happen. Of course it'll happen, and the vaccine is here and this and that. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to write about the kind of, you know, how we, even simple things like, you know, drinking a can in the summertime, you know, or you know, little getting your nails done, getting your hair done. These little kind of things that we might have taken for granted are just going to be such pure joys and pleasures for
us. I love that idea that you have there, that life and joy and crack that we are going to have again, and we will have them again. We don't know when, but we will have them again. What about for you then, Laura, 2020, how difficult was it? Did it manifest itself well in terms of writing?
Well, it didn't. It was up and down. I mean, I definitely empathise with what Roxana is saying. At times I was pulling my hair out. But also I think the practice of writing and just the sort of regime of it is good for me, and it helps to balance me. It's good for my brain to be employed in that way, and just to be able to do something with what I'm feeling, to be able to put the power back in my own hands, I think is. Yeah, it was a way for me of just balancing myself amongst all the rest of the chaos that was going on.
Well, great to speak to the both of you this evening. I presume everything will be happening online now, so we'll have to go to the website to find out full details of how all of that is happening. But that's Laura Quirk and Roxana Nicklaim there speaking to me about the therapy sessions at the First Fortnight Festival, 8th of January in Dublin, 9th in Belfast, 15th in Cork, and finishing up on the 16th of January in Galway. And you can find out full details of how those events will now be happening on firstfortnight.ie. The short list for this year's RTE Choice Music Prize, Irish Album of the Year 2020, was announced today on RTE 2FM's Tracy Clifford Show by Jim Carr, the chair of the judging panel. Great shortlist: Bitch Falcon, Denise Child, Fontaine's DC, J. Yellowell, Roisin Murphy, Nilo, Pillow Queens, Alva Reddy, Niamh Regan, and Silverbacks. All of them among the shortlisted albums. But here's one that we've been hearing quite a bit of this year, but it's always nice to hear it again.
I know my heart, and I know my name, and I know the path that I walk. I work this hard so I can harvest, won't pick my fruit from the low branches. I don't know you, man, but I know dances. Free the journey, who's gonna stop this? I don't need gifts if you look musky, stay philanthropist. Don't need your concern if you'll look at me and see a troper kid. Go on luck like Dirk, don't care what you heard. My word is my bond, and my name is my word, the soul of my world, and it's chile, it's not chalala. Not a hard pill to swallow. Chile or chilea, chia, chila, chila, that's not my name.
It's not her name. Her name is Denise Chila, and that is the title track, Chila, the track there from her album Go Bravely, which is one of the 10 shortlisted albums for this year's RTE Choice Music Prize. The winner will be announced on an RTE 2FM special on the Tracy Clifford Show from 12 to 3pm Thursday the 4th of March, broadcast live on the RTE player, and the show will feature live performances from some of the shortlisted acts, and no doubt we'll be playing, I'd say we'll get to play all 10 of them between now and that announcement in March. Born in Dublin, raised in Limerick, but now based in London, Sinead O'Brien gave up a career working in fashion design with Vivienne Westwood to pursue performance poetry, where she's been creating some waves across the water in recent times. That culminated earlier in 2020 with her signing to Chess Club Records, home to, amongst other people, Mumford & Sons and Wolf Alice. And delighted to have Sinead O'Brien speak to me this evening. It's just an extraordinary story. If you're working as you did initially, you were doing an internship with John Galliano, and then you went to work with Vivienne Westwood. That performance poetry won out from all of that. But tell me the route to into the fashion world, first of all, if you would, Sinead.
Hiya, Sean. Yeah, I'm still working at Vivienne Westwood.
You're still working with her.
I am. It's full time. I've got a full plate. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you when it started, I went to John Galliano straight after graduating in 2012, after I studied at NCAD. And then I was there for about 6 or 9 months. And it was an internship, but it was quite a good one. I had a very hands-on role, and it was, you know, there was some EU funding behind it. So it was more like a training kind of a thing. And then I went to London straight after to join all of my friends who already lived here. And I kind of quite quickly got this kind of a junior design job at Vivienne Westwood. And like, because I had done all of my studies and my thesis on Vivienne, it was great to land that job. It was kind of dreamy.
I can imagine how dreamy it would be, given that she was, you know, that you had studied her and that you're part of your final thesis, as you said. And yeah. I'm not surprised when you say to me that you're still working in the world of fashion, because I was looking at some of the work online today, and the visuals of what you do, it strikes me, are almost as important as the verbal aspect of it, or the musical aspect of it, the aural aspect of it. There probably is no division between the two for you, is there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I tend to kind of put a lot of importance into the project as a whole. I mean, my wall in front of me right now, it's imagery. Often things start as imagery, and then I think it's very circular kind of a thing, you know. It needs to come back around as the videos are very important for me, and of course clothes are very important for me as well, as a mode of expression. Or I mean, it's a bit tricky right now these days. I'm finding myself dressing up in my favorite Westwood pieces in my bedroom with no audience.
the no audience aspect really has become a problem for me. But let's listen to something, and maybe if you tell us a little bit of the visual aspects that are involved in here, it might help us to get a sense of what you were doing. Let's play Most Modern Painting. Tell us what the visuals behind that are.
Most Modern Painting is a piece about the maintenance of the self. So this thing which you have to, you know, you're born and you don't realize, but this is something that you have to kind of eternally take care of yourself, but also to develop yourself and keep on growing and keep on kind of discovering and becoming yourself eventually. So the video, I worked closely with a really great friend of mine, Saskia. She is the director and choreographer for the video. And we kind of wanted to get these small daily gestures in combination with some choreography that kind of felt quite involved with the rhythm and the pace of the music, but has its own a narrative and kind of these cues to these daily, you can spot some very small kind of, you know, like it's almost not noticeable by the end, but it's like certain things like fixing things, or like, you know, these little things you do before you leave the house. Like, what are the few things you notice you do to kind of take care of yourself, or
And what I suppose what's important to say is all of which, all of these movements, the choreographed, as you say, and performed by people who look to me as if they certainly have a background in dance, because they perform the most mundane of actions in a very beautiful and elegant way. Let's have a little to listen to a little bit of most modern painting.
This could be freedom. This is something else. This could be a study on life living. This could be less hooked up on the making. Site-specific installation hooked up on the making. The most modern painting hooked up on the making. The most modern painting. Feeding the ego. Sick, sweet feeling. Back to the dark mirror, Narcissus.
Little section there from Most Modern Painting from Sinead O'Brien, and Sinead speaking to me this evening from London. As I said, Sinead, before we went into that piece, I think the visuals of it are vital to understanding it, and that dance aspect to it, really, really very important. You clearly do work on this very broad canvas across all the art forms. Tell me about your musical collaborators here. It's kind of almost accidental how you met them in some ways, isn't it?
I know. I feel ridiculous when I tell these stories. It's like it's quite lucky. I mean, I don't know what else you can call it, really. Fate, maybe. Yeah. So I had done like an initial performance with a friend of mine, Niall, at this poetry and music night. And I just kind of got a taste for it. And I was like, look, I'm going to have to like get a group of people together to do this with me, because I really want to pursue this. So I'm just kind of like having nights out with my friends and enjoying myself. And on the dance floor one of these such nights, I spot Julian, and we don't speak, but we dance at each other and like make some gestures and some communications and become, I would like, very, very good friends, like instantly. And like it really starts there, and then we just start hanging out and casually playing guitar, and then I start reading my notebooks over what he's playing, and it's all very intuitive. And I mean, you couldn't create that if you tried. It's just, very intuitive. And similar with Oscar then, who plays the drums.
Oscar Robertson. So Julian Hansen and Oscar Robertson are the two involved. So tell us about the meeting with Oscar. That, again, almost accidental.
Yeah, this was ridiculous. I was having a Sunday roast with a friend in a pub in East London, the Royal Oak. It was my favourite pub. It's gone now. And this guy was listening to our conversation. I was saying, I'd love to get a drummer involved at this point. And he said, I've got this wonderful friend. You'd love him. He sounds just like the way you speak. He's going to understand you immediately, the way you speak with these images. And I was like, what harm can this do? Like, let's do an intro. And we met Oscar and had a rehearsal session with him, and that was it.
I'm almost afraid now to ask, how did you bump into John Cooper Clarke? Was he sitting around the corner in another pub that you went into with a friend?
Because
you toured with John Cooper Clarke, didn't you? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. That was wonderful. No, that was more like my determined side, where I email, I'm great at cracking codes. It's how I got the Galliano thing. It's, you know, find the right email, find the person, write them a letter, give them a call, get the thing. So I kind of got the gig myself. It's before I had a manager. And they were just wonderful. They just took me all around the country, and some of my friends joined, and it was great. I didn't have any music though. It was just, like reading the poems in theatre setting, which was really difficult, but like amazing experience to try to give, like, you know, a good performance with nothing else.
It's interesting that you say you had to get up and go out and get the thing. You literally seek it out, because when you said earlier on that, you know, and before I knew it, after my John Galliano internship, I had a job with Vivian Westwood. I thought, there must be a story in there. So it was the phone calls, it was the writing, it was the emails and perseverance, I guess.
Yeah, I'm extremely determined. I mean, I think I knew I was going to work at Galliano, and then I probably knew I was going to work at Westwood. I just didn't know what would come after. That's a kind of a plot twist for me. I did not see this coming at all. Well, but I'm also, equally determined.
Here it is. It's your current EP, Modern Most Modern Painting, which was the piece that we just heard there. And it comes from the EP, Drowning in Blessings. Sinead, lovely to have spoken to you this evening, and enjoy the rest of your evening. Nullig Naman, that's Sinead O'Brien there. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1.